Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Professor Karen Johnson Weiner. Johnson Weiner is professor of anthropology at SUNY Potsdam. She has spent over 25 years studying and doing research on the Amish culture and traditions. She is the author of Train Up a Child, Old Order Amish and Mennonite Schools, and her most recent book, published this past June from Cornell University Press, is called New York Amish, Life in the Plain Communities of the Empire State. I'm speaking to Karen Johnson Weiner by phone from her office in Potsdam, New York. Karen Johnson Weiner, thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
Now, before we begin to talk about your absolutely fascinating new book called New York Amish, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to be so interested in studying the Amish culture?
Purely by chance. I heard some Amish folks, and they were speaking German, and although I was a linguist by training, I was blown away by the fact that Pennsylvania Dutch seemed to be spoken in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I managed to meet a couple of people who began to teach me Pennsylvania German, Pennsylvania Dutch. And before too long, I was far more interested in why they were still speaking this language rather than the language itself. And that led me into the study of Amish culture.
It's a fascinating culture, absolutely. Now, let's start with the beginning. The Amish have been settling in New York State for nearly 200 years. Can you tell us a little bit about what attracted them to this state in the early days?
Land.
Mm-hmm.
Land and the opportunity to farm. I mean, they were attracted here the way many European immigrants were. Land was available, and it seemed to come without all of the other things that were bothering them back in Europe, war, heavy taxes, and all of that. And so they came here really seeking the opportunity to raise their families in peace and farm. And that's pretty much what continues to draw them here today.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how the integrity of the community is reinforced by their rejection of modern technology. Tell us how that is such a part of their culture. And I understand that some of it has changed with some of the communities.
Well, that's true. I should say that, you know, we talk about the Amish as if, you know, there were Amish, but there are lots of different kinds of Amish.
Mm-hmm.
And each community, each church district, I should say, that is the group that gathers to worship, is a unit complete in itself. Now, a church district may fellowship with other church districts, that is, exchange ministers or, you know, young people may marry. But each district makes its rules for itself, following Amish guidelines. And so really there are roughly 1,800 church districts, so there are about 1,800 different ways of being Amish. And each has drawn the line that separates themselves from our world a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that line will determine what kinds of technology they use or don't use. And it's not that they're against technology. What they believe is that to really practice God's laws in a way that will make them worthy of salvation, they have to be separate from the world. And that means basically separating themselves from many of the things the world does and uses, including technology. So they don't have anything against technology itself. It's just that they've decided that to use this kind of technology or this particular piece of technology would make it harder for them to live a Christian life.
Mm-hmm. And there have been some chasms between some communities because some people have let in modern conveniences like telephones and so on. That's correct,
mm-hmm.
right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, some Amish groups do have telephones. Usually, well, they don't put them inside the house, but maybe in an entryway, in a shop, and others want nothing to do with that. So there are some real gaps, and some Amish may find understanding another kind of Amish as difficult as we might find understanding that Amish.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder, too, in regard to rejecting modern technology, how do they deal with the fact that sometimes they need to go to modern hospitals? Is that allowed?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. It's an odd line for us to understand. But, you know, for example, the Amish have nothing against the automobile. And Amish have ridden in automobiles. Amish will hire drivers. But that's not the same as owning an automobile. And if you own that technology, if you bring it into your house, that will have an impact on your life. So you can make use of it, you know, the Amish will shop in modern stores and mm-hmm. go to modern hospitals, make use of the telephone, you know, in a public payphone. But they're keeping that technology in its place. They're keeping control over it in a way that they wouldn't be able to if they actually let it into the house.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. Okay, I was just wondering, a lot of people have asked me, well, do they go to hospitals? Do they take advantage of modern medicine and so on? And
well, yeah.
I didn't have an answer to that. So
they know. Do, but it how much will depend on the group itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything else, well, yes, but depends on the community.
Yeah, I understand that. Talk to us also about the unique dress styles that they've maintained through many, almost centuries. The women wear bonnets, the you know, dark mm-hmm. dresses, mm-hmm. straw hats. Where did that tradition come from?
Well, it's really a matter of not changing when the rest of the world changed. You know, people in our culture, for the most part, stopped making all of their own clothes for everybody from scratch when they became available cheaply through mass production. Well, the Amish didn't follow those fashions. Key for the Amish is that God's truth doesn't change. Why should we? And mm-hmm. they look at our world, and every season there's something new you should wear and some new color you should wear. And dress helps them stay away from all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it also provides a visible sign that they are not of the world. So dress draws the line between their world and ours. It also helps identify communities because depending on the group an Amish person is with, that will determine what kind of hat the men are wearing, what kind of haircut the men have. There are commonalities. All Amish men grow their beards and don't grow mustaches, shave their mustaches. And that's a rejection of military styles, you know, of a couple hundred years ago. And you can see the old prints with men having flamboyant mustaches. The no mustache is a rejection of that kind of military style. The lack of buttons on Amish women's garments, these straight pins the women do to fasten their dresses and that, goes back to the first days of the Amish. It was a way that the Amish distinguished themselves from the Mennonites after the two groups split. So there are elements of Amish dress that go way back. There are other elements that are more 19th century and reflect the growing divergence between the Amish world and the non-Amish world.
Mm-hmm. Is it true among all the groups that the women always wear bonnets and when they're married they wear white and when they're single they wear black bonnets? Is that uniform across most Amish communities?
Roughly. Mm-hmm. Some communities, little girls won't wear caps until they're school age. The caps, of course, are different from community to community. In many communities, single women, once they've reach their, you know, late 20s, 30s, once they stop identifying with the young folk, will start wearing a white cap. And the color of the cap that a woman wears sort of on weekdays will often be different from the color of the cap she wears at church.
Hmm.
So an unmarried woman may be wearing a white cap during the day but still wear a black cap to church. So cap colors will distinguish marriage, non-marriage, also distinguish age, distinguish daily life from church life, and distinguish group from group.
it
gets complicated.
Yeah, that isn't. It is hard to follow some of that. Now, children are only in school up until the eighth grade. Why has that tradition been maintained?
Again, that reflects our world changing and their world not changing. You know, up until the turn of the 19th to the 20th centuries, many kids ended it at eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
In the 20th century, education started to change in our world. You had longer school years, and you had more years of compulsory education. And so the Amish didn't want to go along with that. And with the Supreme Court ruling in Wisconsin versus Yoder, 1972, they were excused from going along with that. So they were basically given their right not to send their children on to high school. And for the Amish, the Amish way of thinking is that in school you can get the book learning you need. And the curriculum will vary somewhat from school to school. But basically you're learning to read and to write English, which is what the Amish use for written communication.
Mm-hmm.
You're learning to do arithmetic, which you need for business and for sewing and for measuring and things like that. You may be studying geography and health, but the things you really need to live an Amish life, how to run a farm, how to do carpentry, how to sew and to can and to take care of children and those kinds of things, that you really need to learn at home. Mm-hmm. And so when the Amish person leaves school, their education is continuing, but it's education in the values and the way of life that will help them be Amish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm assuming that they're usually homeschooled by their own families, or are teachers called in?
No, they're not homeschooled, because part of going to school is learning to get along with others in the community. So the Amish generally do not homeschool. In New York State, most Amish communities have their own little private schools that are located in the community itself. Some Amish, not so much in New York State, though there are some children who start out in public school, but, you know, in some areas of Amish settlement, Amish children are still going to public school. We think of homeschooling because we say, well, here's a conservative group and they want to keep the children in the family.
Mm-hmm.
But the Amish generally frown on homeschooling because that would encourage a kind of individualism that would not be good for the community.
Hmm. Oh, that's fascinating to me. Because I was wondering if all the kids just have an eighth grade education, how do they hire teachers? How do they find teachers?
From within the community.
Uh-huh.
I had one Amish person say to me that the worst thing a local school board can hear, and a school board is elected from the families who send their children to that particular private school. So this one Amish fellow told me that the worst thing the school board could hear is that the teacher's got a boyfriend, because that would mean that she's going to get married and will stop teaching and they have to find a new teacher. They're going to look for the teacher within their own community. Usually it's going to be a young girl, probably about 17 years of age.
Hmm.
Her parents will negotiate with the school board for her because she's not an adult yet in the Amish world. And ideally it's going to be a girl who was a good student herself. And some girls do know that they want to be teachers. They enjoy school. And it's often a big surprise for the scholars, as the Amish call children in school, for the scholars to arrive at the school and see who the teacher is. You know, it may even be their older sister, and it's been secret. So the school board will hire generally a young girl, sometimes a young man, from the local community or from a fellowshipping church or another church in the area. And then that teacher will teach school.
Hmm.
Often she has no particular training, though some of the more progressive groups do have teachers' meetings, which allow the teachers to meet with other teachers in other schools and to share ideas. So,
So they, in some ways, they continue learning and growing in that way. Now, I do want to talk to you, because I know you're pretty much of an expert on the language. What mm-hmm. does that mean, Pennsylvania German? How is that different from traditional German?
Well, it's a dialect of German that, you know, was spoken along the Rhine area, and the first immigrants brought it with them. And just as the English spoken by immigrants from England has changed in the time that people have been in the United States, that German has changed too. It's a non-standard language, meaning that it differs from community to community, and some communities find it very difficult to other Stan speakers in other communities. For example, there's a strain called Swiss or Schwyza that the regular Pennsylvania Dutch speakers often find difficult to understand. So it's been here, it's changed, it's evolved here in North America. It's a recognizably German dialect, but it's not the same as German anymore.
Hmm, that's fascinating. So it's probably a little bit like Afrikaners is to the Dutch language.
In a sense, yeah. Yeah. The Amish are linguistically very, very interesting because, you know, each Amish person is really trilingual. They're getting foreign language in their schools, and that they start school. And for many Amish children, that's when they start to learn English, is in first grade. So they're learning to read and write English, but they also study a more standard German in order to read their Bible, which is the Luther Bible. And in order to read their hymn book, the Ausbund, which they've been using for 400 years. So it's complicated.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Karen Johnson Weiner. We're talking about her newly published book, New York Amish, Life in the Plain Communities of the Empire State. Now, let's talk a little bit about religion, because that is central to the Amish life. All the formal positions are held by men. Talk to us about this part of the culture.
The formal church hierarchy is male, and that reflects that sort of divine hierarchy, God over man, over woman, and so on. The Amish young person joins church and has to make a decision to become baptized, and they do this at about age 17 or 18, depending on the group, but they join church older, and it comes with baptism, and the baptismal vow is really a promise to God to obey God's laws as practiced by the church, the Amish church. For men, that means being available to serve as a minister or as a bishop, if called, if they are chosen in the lot. When a church district needs a new minister, all church members, male and female, come together to help choose a minister. And what this means is they will nominate someone to be minister. Every church member will go up to the existing church leadership, will nominate someone. Those getting two or three nominations go into a back room, and then they come out in order of age, and on a church bench will be placed a number of hymnals, one of which will have a piece of paper with a Bible verse in it. And in order of age, they'll come out, and they will pick up a hymn book, and the person that has the hymn book with the piece of paper in it is the new minister. And the bishops are chosen from among the existing ministers. So it's a leadership that is really chosen in a combination of democracy, with every church member, male and female, getting a say. But God makes the decision. And then, now, we tend to think that, you know, okay, there's a bishop. He must be in charge. And we think of a very hierarchical structure. In fact, most church decisions are really a consensus. The group itself has to all be in agreement, and so a bishop who acted unilaterally would probably not stay long as the bishop of the community. So all church decision-making really involves everybody, and to sort of reinforce this group consensus twice a year before communion, all church members, and again, that's adults, those who've been baptized, will come together, and they will go over the ordnung, or the discipline of the church, and then each church member has to indicate that they are content with this, that they're in agreement. And if there are disagreements, then the church isn't one group and can't go on to the next step, which would be communion. So it's an organization that really gives everyone a voice. Everyone has to really work actively to keep the church healthy.
That sounds like democracy. Now talk to us a little bit about the tradition of banning and shunning. What would provoke this treatment? I'm sure most of my listeners have heard of this. Tell us what would provoke a banning or a shunning.
Well, it's stems directly from this notion of the church as a group of believers who are coming together to put God's word into practice in a way that the church has figured out through this consensus to do. So each church community has its ordnung, or its church discipline, and when someone is baptized, they're making a promise to God that they will follow church, that they will attempt to lead a Christian life by following this ordinum. If someone then sins or goes against the ways of the church, that person is visited by the ministry, who'll call that person to account, at which point that person has a choice. Do I give up what I've been doing? Do I, you know, confess and remain part of the fellowship, or do I decide, no, I'm going to keep doing whatever, you know, I want to own my telephone, or I want to, you know, buy a car or whatever. at which point that person is considered to have broken his promise to God and has removed himself from the fellowship. The rest of the church members have also made the same promise to God. And if they were to continue to interact with this person, they too would be breaking their promise. So they have really no alternative but to shun that person, to put them in bond. And what that means really depends on the group. It may mean not eating with them at the same table. It may mean having no social interaction whatsoever. But excommunication, taking yourself out of the fellowship, and the shunning that follows is, you know, for members of the church, something the individual has done to himself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an irrevocable decision. I mean, this person could decide at any time to come back to the church, to say, you know, look, I was wrong. I made confession. I really want to follow church. At which point, you know, he's no longer being shunned. He's no longer in bond.
Hmm.
And can go on to be an absolutely accepted, productive member of the community. So excommunication is not anything final. In fact, church members hope that it will be a sort of tough love, that it will bring the person to their senses, to realize the enormity of what they're doing.
There is a huge tradition in the Amish culture for forgiveness.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
The Amish know that God, through Christ, is going to forgive them, and their goal is to act, you know, following Christ's example, which means forgiving others.
Mm-hmm. And I think many of my listeners will remember that horrible case in Lancaster County in 2006,
mm-hmm.
when it was a member of the community who came in and shot all those schoolgirls, and the Amish community forgave, and people
mm-hmm.
were astonished by that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a case that I'm sure most people do remember. Now tell us, how do the Amish unwind? Do they party? Do they have fun? Tell us how they deal with entertainment.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have had some of the most enjoyable times in Amish homes with joke telling, and it's important to know that the Amish don't draw that strict line we do between work and play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we go to work, and then, you know, for a few weeks every year we get to have vacation, and then we're supposed to not work. For the Amish, there's not that sharp distinction, because you can have fun while working. And in fact, a tradition among the Amish is the frolic, which is a work party. You know, if you're butchering, well, get people over to help you butcher. If you're going to build a new barn, get people over to help you build the barn. And then you'll have people in the kitchen cooking together. And, you know, so fun comes in that kind of doing things together, and the joking and the talking and the, you know, the singing that can go on when everybody comes together to, you know, to work, to help each other. For young people, and I know people talk about Rumspringa, the running around period. For young people, there are different kinds of activities that they'll engage in, depending on the group, and that may mean volleyball. It may mean singing together. So those kinds of activities go on. There are in some groups school picnics where, you know, parents will bring a hot lunch to the school room to feed the children, and then everybody will play baseball or a variation of baseball. There are a lot of different kinds of things going on. And then there's just the, you know, the joke telling, the storytelling that goes on anytime people are gathered around the dinner table. So, yeah, the Amish are having a good time.
Now, the basic philosophy seems to be to farm so that families can continue to be, you know, part of the natural world and governed still by the seasons. A
mm-hmm.
lot of take back the earth and take back the land people feel that way, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
the Amish are, you know, they consider farming to be the ideal occupation. Because it sort of teaches dependency on God. You know, for the Amish, it's key to give up your own individual will, to yield to God's will, to yield to God's laws and to do things following Christ's example. And farming is probably the ideal occupation for that because there are some things you just can't change. You know, if you're going to have a summer with no rain, well, then you have to give up because there's nothing you can do about it. If you're going to have a summer with too much rain or tomato blight hits, you give up. So the idea is you work hard, you trust God, and farming encourages that kind of trust and yielding up of one's own will.
Mm-hmm.
So while many Amish people have other occupations, I mean, they're carpenters, they're builders, they're, you know, saddle makers and seamstresses and cleaning people, they all want to have farming somewhere in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you hope the wider community will take from this book that you just released and are obviously talking about?
I hope that they will come to appreciate their new Amish neighbors if they're having them. I mean, people have a lot of misconceptions. I've heard people say, "Oh, they don't pay taxes," which they do. You know, they don't do this, that, or the other. So my hope is that the book will help people learn about their new Amish neighbors if they're getting them. New York is seeing a population explosion of Amish settlement. I hope they'll come to appreciate the diversity of the Amish because there are a lot of different kinds of Amish moving into the state. And I hope that they will learn basically something more realistic about the Amish than is often out there. You know, TV and popular fiction puts out all sorts of images of the Amish. And so my attempt is to really get rid of some of the myths that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
So just to help people. I've learned a lot from my Amish friends. I just want to share some of what I've learned.
Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you this. Did you let some of your Amish friends and some of the people that you obviously contacted when you were writing this book, did you let them read the final draft?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
And did you make any changes?
It's, you know, people, I would send copies of the chapters to different people. And they would write me back and say, well, this wasn't quite it, or, you know. So hopefully what I ended up with is as accurate as an outsider could make it.
That's great. Karen Johnson-Weiner, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called New York Amish, Life in the Plain Communities of the Empire State. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.